This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. Join us today for stories about the world's most vulnerable people and those who make a difference in their lives. On this week's program, leprosy. The disease can be cured, but the stigma remains. We visit a leper's colony in a Nigerian forest.
People are afraid of us, that leprosy is infectious, and that because of this illness, that we can't actually be near them. That is the reason why we went far away, to this place.
Because of that shame.
Plus, an innovative approach to helping the mentally ill in Oregon. And North African immigrants risk their lives to get to Europe, but many find life in the promised land isn't so promising.
Some days, I make about $25. Some days, $5. Some days, $50. Some days, I make nothing. As the Spanish say, nada.
That's coming up on the World Vision Report. For people with severe mental illness, a task that's simple on one day can be overwhelming the next, like doing laundry, refilling a prescription, or vacuuming. So once or twice a week, personal care attendants visit more than 600 Oregonians living with mental illness. Ann Dornfeld took a look at the program, one of the first of its kind in the country.
It's Saturday afternoon, and this discount grocery store in Eugene, Oregon, is full of oversized carts, whining kids, frazzled parents, and a squawking PA system. Amid this chaos, Tiffany Tupper is serene. She glides through the aisles looking for healthy refried beans.
No fat traditional. I'm looking for ones with no lard, actually.
Passing Tupper in the aisle, you'd never guess she has severe agoraphobia, fear of public places, as well as panic and anxiety disorders and a phobia of dirt. But on this day, Tupper has help. At her side is Debbie Thomas, Tupper's personal care attendant.
The same protein, 7 grams, yep, everything's the same.
Tupper has been living with mental disability for as long as she can remember. 2 years ago, the 34-year-old's illness became overwhelming. Tupper quit her job at a nursing home because being around people gave her panic attacks. She became a prisoner in her own home. Then a year ago, Debbie Thomas was assigned to Tupper's case.
Yeah, when I met Deb, I didn't leave my bedroom. She came over and helped me do dishes and clean my bathroom so I could leave my room.
But she does everything now. She's really come quite a ways.
These days, Thomas spends up to 20 hours a month helping Tupper run errands, get to doctor's appointments, and organize her tiny apartment. The goal of the Personal Care Attendant Program, PCA for short, is to help the state's poorest mentally ill people live more independently. The state of Oregon funds it, with Medicaid providing matching dollars. The program lightens the load for the more highly trained mental health case managers, letting them focus on social work instead of housework. The state pays Thomas about $9 an hour for her PCA work. Thomas has a psychology degree, but she says that may not be her most important qualification. Thomas herself suffers from mental illness.
I mean, I've got psychosis, anxiety, so I take about 9 different drugs, and I see the doctors over at Lane Mental Health, too. So this is one thing I can do. It gets me out of the house and helps me out, too.
Michael Moore is the Adult Services Coordinator for the Oregon Department of Human Services. He says there's a good reason why the state hires PCAs who are capable but struggle with mental illness themselves. They can better empathize with their clients, he says. The extra income helps, too, because most of the PCAs are on fixed incomes. Moore says research shows that having a job provides more benefits for the mentally ill than just a paycheck.
When people go to work, the symptoms of their mental illness actually go down quite a bit. And that makes sense to me, intuitive sense. If you're sitting at home, not doing much, you're going to probably dwell a little bit on yourself. It's not probably too great on the brain.
Although Oregon hasn't done any studies on the program, Moore has a hunch that PCAs save the state money by keeping clients out of the hospital. The program has plenty of room to grow. The state has an estimated 100,000 adults with serious, persistent mental illness. Few can afford such help on their own. Tiffany Tupper says she wouldn't want to live without her PCA, and the feeling is mutual.
When Deb and I are hanging out, driving around, I don't feel like I'm sick. It's nice to feel normal.
Yeah.
It's like we're just acting like normal people, even though it's harder for us than people could comprehend. It's nice to feel just like everybody else.
As soon as she feels up to it, Tupper hopes to volunteer at a group home for the mentally ill. She's learned what a difference a little extra help can make. For the World Vision Report, I'm Ann Dornfeld in Eugene, Oregon.
There are lots of myths about leprosy. The disease is curable, and it's not highly contagious. But if it's not caught early, it can cause progressive and permanent damage to the skin, nerves, limbs, and eyes. In the West African nation of Nigeria, people who suffer from leprosy face a terrible stigma. They're often abandoned by their families and friends and left to fend for themselves. Even after they've been treated and cured, most former leprosy patients in Nigeria don't go home. Instead, they live together in isolated forests. That's where they go to escape discrimination. Sam Olokoya visited some of the lepers and produced this report. Bwalya Melu narrates the story.
The Abo Forest in southwest Nigeria is home to about 70 former leprosy patients. They stay in dark, tiny huts made of disused old cement bags, sticks, and leaves. They must contend with mosquitoes, snakes, thieves, and the rainy season that destroys their makeshift homes. They drink dirty water from a nearby stream. But despite all this, they feel it's better to live here than to be treated like pariahs by the rest of Nigerian society.
People are always scaring us out that leprosy is infectious.
People are afraid of us, that leprosy is infectious. And that because of this illness, that we can't actually be near them.
That is the reason why we just went as far.
That is the reason why we went far away, to this place. Because of that shame.
Isaiah Ojabulu lost parts of his palms and toes to leprosy after he contracted the disease in his final year in high school. He says all his friends deserted him. He was cured by antibiotics, but because his deformities remain, people mistakenly think he's still contagious. So 6 years ago, Isaiah chose to settle here in the forest because of the prejudice he faces, even from his own family.
I still feel a sense of discrimination because sometimes now if I go to my family
house... I still feel a sense of discrimination if I go to my family house. Before I bathe, the towels and sponges that are in the bathroom are taken away. I feel that they removed all these things because of my disease. That is part of why I feel like not going home.
Despite the harsh conditions, somehow, people have created a life in this forest. Inside one of the huts, Lucky Igbo sits with his wife, Blessing, who's breastfeeding a five-month-old baby, one of their two children. Lucky has been cured of leprosy, but he has lost parts of his fingers and toes to the disease. Blessing never had it, but she has chosen to live with her husband here in the forest.
I don't want to leave my husband. That is why...
I don't want to leave my husband. That was why I came here. I will stay with my husband because I love him so much.
In most cases, marriages in Nigeria break up when one partner contracts the disease, but not this one.
The time when my husband was sick.
There was a time my husband was very sick. People kept telling me to leave him. They said he was a burden to me, that I should find someone else to marry me. I used to cry a lot. One time I even wanted to commit suicide. And then I realized that I was allowing people to torture my mind. Since then, if someone else tells me to leave my husband, I tell them no. I cannot abandon him just because he was sick.
But others are not here by choice. There are about 25 children staying in this forest encampment with their parents. There is no school for them here. So some parents have tried sending their children to live with relatives. But the kids often end up victims of discrimination themselves. 10-year-old Ejero Samson sits outside her hut, grinding pepper on a grinding stone. Until recently, she had been staying with the relative in town, but the relative beat her, she says, so her mother brought her back to the forest. The child, however, says life in the forest is too hard.
I don't like to stay for the camp. I like to go to school.
I don't like it here. I want to go to school. But if I stay here, I will not be able to. My mother is poor, and she does not have any money. I am suffering. I would like somebody to put me through school.
But that dream is likely to go unfulfilled. Children like Ejero spend their days doing the things their parents can't do because of their disabilities. Fetching water, buying food at the market whenever there's money, and splitting wood with an axe for cooking. Everyone, no matter what their age or physical condition, begs for money. This road is the highway between the cities of Lagos and Benin. It is one of the busiest highways in Nigeria. Thousands and thousands of vehicles ply it every day. And it's just a short distance from the leprosy settlement. So the lepers come here every day, hands outstretched, and line the roadside. Some sing when they beg. Sunday Eza is one of the beggars here today.
So this is, as we not get help, so
there is nobody to help us. Yeah, that is why we are here on the highway.
Throughout this road one with this
begging at the roadside is our saving grace.
This way we are.
But for this road, many of us would have died of starvation.
But the road has its perils. Some beggars have died from traffic accidents here, including Sunday's wife. Back in the forest, the lepers say they hope they won't have to live this way forever. They've teamed up to form a human rights association aimed at fighting the discrimination they face. They want the government to give them monthly disability payments and provide jobs for some of them in leprosy hospitals. Meanwhile, as Sunday Eza and others wait for acceptance, they have found friends. Church groups from a nearby Benin city who do outreach for the poor have been coming to this forest to worship with them and to urge them not to despair. The former leprosy patients say this gives them the fortitude to face the circumstances and the belief that their tribulations will come to an end someday. For the World Vision Report, I am Walya Melu for Sam Olukoya, Agbo Forest, Nigeria.
The caste system governs everyday life in India. At the top of the social hierarchy are the Brahmins, and at the very bottom are the Dalits, or the untouchables. Higher caste Indians believe the Dalits pollute them. As a result, the Dalit caste suffers terrible abuse. They live in dire poverty. Joseph D'Souza grew up as a privileged Brahmin, but he was a Christian, part of a very small minority in the country. And he didn't subscribe to Hindu beliefs about the caste system or anything else. I sat down to talk with Joseph D'Souza about his work with the Dalit Freedom Network, fighting for the rights of Dalits across India. He told me he first came to know a so-called untouchable when he fell in love with one.
30 years ago, I met my wife Mariam. She was from the Dalit population. I'm not supposed to fall in love with a Dalit. I'm not supposed to get close to a Dalit. But I met, she was a Christian, I was a Christian. We met in North India, and I wanted to marry her. So I proposed, and she said, okay, if you want to marry me, come and see what my life is, because you've grown in an urban area, you're an upper caste kid, you don't know what this is all about. So I had to go to her village and see what life was, and it shook the daylight out of me.
You had lived all your life up until then in India and had never seen how the Dalits lived?
No. I had to, just to get to a place, I had to walk three hours away from a bus station. And there was no electricity there. There was no roads there. There was no school there. There was no sanitation there. And then the way they were treated by the powerful and the landed, and the kind of poverty and the kind of dehumanization, and the fact that many of their children were being, especially the girls, were sexually abused. I mean, it's just a nightmare.
What went through your mind when you visited the village of this Dalit woman who you had fallen in love with?
What went through my mind? I couldn't understand my crazy country. And I thought, what on earth is, you know, I never knew this. And I was shocked, and first time I came into contact with this other India.
You work among the Dalits. What are some of the things you've seen happen to the Dalits that concern you most?
What concerns me most is the trafficking of children. and the selling of boys and girls into bonded labor and then abuse in the homes of the rich and powerful. The government has just passed a law because of international pressure, but child labor is not going to end in India. Then you hear about all of the sex trafficking that's going on. I mean, report after report now says India is both the source and destination of all of the sex trafficking that's going on.
What is the religious belief that feeds this philosophy that these people are so low down that they don't deserve any rights at all?
The belief behind that is that in this life they are cursed. They are under the curse of God. God is punishing them for sins in a past life, and so they deserve everything so they can be exploited, they can be raped, they can be sold, they can be killed. You can do anything you want to them because they are Dalits.
You started an organization called the Dalit Freedom Network. What does it do?
The Dalit Freedom Network came in response to the cry of the Dalit people in India who said, look, this thing has to be demolished in our generation, in our lifetime. And the way we're going to demolish is it in a fourfold project. One, we're going to educate and empower and train and take care of our children. You know, 40 million child laborers in India, majority of them are Dalit low caste. 15 million, they say, bonded child laborers in India, 80 to 85% Dalit. How do you free them? How do you touch them? Bring them in education centers, bring them in schools, bring them for training and give them an education before they are sold into the child market. Program number two is social justice. Let's make this a national and global issue. Issue number three was there's absolutely no health care for these 250 million people. When the tsunami hit India, it's common knowledge. The tsunami relief went to the upper sections of society and the Dalits were discriminated even in the tsunami relief. So there's no health care. And fourthly, of course, is economic development. Everything that they have owned has been taken away from them. So developing their economic life is extremely important and empowering them.
Do you get much resistance to this movement to erase the barriers between the Dalits and the higher castes?
Yes, especially from the religious leaders within the caste system and the right-wing Hindu groups. They are the ones who are most opposed to this.
Why?
Because they lose their power. They lose their religious power. They lose their social power. They lose their economic power. And they've been having free slaves. Who wouldn't have 300 million free slaves?
Is it at all risky for you to be doing this, to try to break down the barriers between the Dalits and other castes?
It is risky because you are taking on a system that has exploited the masses and a small minority has profited from it, and you're challenging the hegemony of the minority. But they have no voice. They have no voice to come and speak here or anywhere else and say, hey, this is my story. And sooner or later, evil has to meet its end.
Joseph D'Souza, International Director of the Dalit Freedom Network, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
The Dalit Freedom Network fights for human rights for Dalits or untouchables across India. And now, our globe at a glance. British pop star Elton John has been touring Southern Africa these last few weeks, but he hasn't been there to perform or see the sights. He's there to check on the work that his AIDS Foundation is doing in that part of the world. While in the mountainous kingdom of Lesotho, Elton John donated 120 motorbikes to help doctors and nurses do their rounds. He's hoping this will help bring health care to people living in remote parts of the country. The five-year motorbike program is being run in partnership with the Lesotho government. It'll help maintain the bikes, and it will teach local health care workers how to ride safely on Lesotho's rural roads. And that's our Globe at a Glance. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer, and you're listening to the World Vision Report. Every year, about 300,000 Mexicans head north to the U.S. in search of better jobs. Sometimes they leave behind poorer-paying jobs, and that poses a problem for their Mexican employers. Conrad Fox reports from the village of Guadalupe in southern Veracruz.
Sugarcane farmer Jose Sarate stands in the midst of 8-foot-high sugarcane. sharpening a machete and looking closely at his plants. The leaves are brown and the cane is thin.
The fields fill up with water and damage the crops. That's why it's like this.
Ideally, Sarate's entire 14 acres of crop would have been harvested by now, but it's languished in the field a full 3 months longer than it should have.
It's taking too long to harvest. I used to do well when we harvested in time.
Why the delay? There's simply not enough local labor here anymore. Martin Ruiz is the head of the local growers' organization.
Everyone's immigrated to the U.S. We took a census recently and found 700 neighbors were in the U.S. out of a population of 3,400. We've got a shortfall of 1,400 workers, so we've got to bring in people from other states, and that's expensive.
Out in a field that borders Jose Sarate's, 140 men slash at the sugar canes with machetes, then fling them on bundles that will later be hauled away by truck. They'll do this for 7 hours, 12 hours a day. The temperature is 104 degrees, and because the fields are set alight the day before to burn off undergrowth, the men are black from head to toe with soot. One of them is Miguel Hilario, a Mazatec Indian from a remote village hundreds of miles away in the state of Oaxaca.
It's hard. It's hard, but you gotta tough it out. If you don't, you don't eat. All day working. You don't go to the shade because then you don't earn anything. Here you earn a bit at least. Back home, there's nothing.
5 years ago, this job was a staple for local laborers. But increasingly, entire families have been emigrating from the region to the U.S. Farmers have had to hire workers like Hilario from other, poorer parts of the country, where emigration hasn't yet taken hold, usually in remote indigenous villages. Carmela Rodriguez is the owner of this small field. Like Jose Sarate, she says she earned about $2,000 on her crop last year. She complains hiring workers from such out-of-the-way places is eating up that small profit.
We're paying to bring them here. We pay their transport, their accommodation, and a lot of them, they come up, work 2 weeks, and then disappear. And what are we supposed to do? Last year, we had to cut all the crops ourselves.
Every year, Rodriguez and her neighbors chip in for the costs of finding and bringing workers from Oaxaca and other poor southern states. This season, well over half the laborers are from other states. And while that's driven up farmers' costs, the workers' wages have stayed the same, about $70 a week. Sergio Falcón, who helps run this farm, admits it's not a living wage.
You can hardly survive on it. There's no money if you get sick. If you buy food, you've got nothing left over for a soda.
But, say farmers like Falcón and Rodriguez, sugar prices are too low to pay any more than that. And as long as prices are low, laborers will keep crossing the border to the U.S. in search of work. And it's not only laborers. Now, even the sugarcane farmers who employ them are going too. People like Sergio Falcón.
I work in the U.S. temporarily. I've been there 3 times now. I've got to, because otherwise, what do we do? Imagine trying to support a family on $2,000 a year.
At the beginning of this year, tariffs that Mexico places on sugar imports from the U.S. disappeared as part of the North American Free Trade Agreement. The threat of new competition has many sugarcane farmers talking about leaving the business for good. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Guadalupe, Veracruz, Mexico.
Just as Mexicans brave deserts and danger to get to America in search of a better life, so Africans cross dangerous seas to get to Europe. The number of Africans risking their lives to get to Europe soared last year. More than 30,000 migrants touched down in Spain's Canary Islands, Europe's southernmost point. Some estimate thousands more perished en route. Many of those lucky enough to get to Europe discover it's not the land of plenty they had expected. Daniela Gerson brings us this story from Granada, Spain, as part of our Street Vendor series.
As night unfolds, tourists mingle with locals at tapas bars that line every corner of this fabled city. Weaving among them is a lean black man in his mid-30s, who identifies himself only as Muhammad. He enters a crowded bar and flashes a cautious smile.
Hola, amigo, amiga. Película o bien música?
Muhammad, an illegal immigrant from Senegal, grasps a black plastic bag filled with bootleg DVDs. He approaches the bar's patrons, offering movies for sale. The competition is stiff. This tourist district is closely guarded by police, but even so, a growing stream of illegal African vendors flows by, offering similar wares.
Some days, I make about $25. Some days, $5. Some days, $50. Some days, I make nothing. As the Spanish say, nada.
Muhammad may smile, but he isn't happy with his life in Spain. He hasn't found the easy dollars that enticed him to leave his native San Luis, a port city in Senegal. He trained as a carpenter there, but he could barely make enough money to live on. Life in Spain isn't any better. After a month in Granada, Muhammad can hardly support himself, let alone send money back to his family.
Well, why am I here? I wanted to earn a lot of money. That's why I'm here. I want to do it for my father, my mother, my brothers, and my younger sister.
It took Muhammad 6 months to save enough money to be smuggled to Europe. When the day arrived, he joined 80 other illegal migrants and boarded a raft. Of the ensuing 15 days at sea, he will only say it was very hard. Whatever happened, his boat was among the lucky ones and made it to the Canary Islands. From there, it took him several weeks to make his way to continental Europe, in an apartment which he shares with 6 other Africans. Within 3 days of arriving in Granada, he was selling DVDs. He knows it's a dangerous job. The police could catch him at any moment and send him back to Senegal, but it's the only way to make money. A roommate gives him the merchandise to sell. Where it comes from is a mystery to Muhammad.
We have our CDs, and we put them on the ground to sell. It's not normal, but we have to do it to eat.
Enjoying their beers and snacks, the patrons barely look up at Muhammad. Another vendor had passed by 15 minutes before, and no one bought from him either. Undeterred, Muhammad leaves and heads up the hill to the next tapas bar. For the World Vision Report, I'm Daniela Gerson in Granada, Spain.
And that brings us to the end of our show this week. You can hear the program anytime at our website, worldvisionreport.org. If you'd like to take us with you, you can download a podcast. Our radio team includes Doug Boyles, Mark Bandy, Cynthia Graber, Diane Toomey, and I'm Peggy Waymire. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.